This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Fred Bever in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. In less than a month, the Senate Finance Committee is expected to finalize a budget, and the committee heard from hundreds of Granite Staters about that this week. The open hearing drew long lines and passionate pleas. Many came to ask senators to undo cuts the House proposed that would slash funding for social services. Those included drug treatment programs. Judy Tilton spoke at the hearing.
My youngest son decided to dabble in heroin. A mere 4 weeks later, 4 weeks, he had pleaded with heroin. I found him dead in his room of an overdose of pure fentanyl, 21 years old and gone. That was 33 days ago.
Also in the Capitol, both chambers have passed bills that would create the crime of fetal homicide, but concerns over the bill's details have yet to be worked out. Republican Leon Rideout of Lancaster sponsored the bill that passed the House.
38 other states currently have a fetal homicide law using virtually the same language and have been using it successfully for over 40 years.
And likely Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie returned to the Granite State for the first time since indictments were handed down in the Bridgegate scandal. He brushed off sinking polling numbers.
No, I don't think there's any indication at all. I think the poll you're talking about said 5% of the people in the poll said they'd made up their mind. So I'm more than happy to work on the other 95%, and we'll be just fine.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Let us hear from you. Call in. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, we have three guests in the studio right now. They are Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Thanks for coming, Gary.
Good to be here, Fred.
Also, Josh Rogers, NHPR's own senior political reporter. Thanks for stopping by, Josh.
Good morning, Fred.
And Dean Spiliades, the civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and the author of the website nhppoliticalcapital.com. Thanks for being here, Dean.
Good morning, Fred.
So concerned citizens piled into the State House this week to put the arm on senators and the Finance Committee who are working through their version of the state budget. Gary Reno, how is the Senate differing from the House? Where are they headed?
Well, the Senate always has the advantage because they get the budget last. And the real big advantage they have is that they have the insight of seeing what happens in March and April for revenues for the state. They're two huge months for the state, largely because of business taxes and interest and dividend tax returns are due in March and April. And so they have a better idea of what the finances really look like than the House does when they're dealing with it about 3 months before that. But what they're finding, and they also have a better idea of what the spending is and where programs are going and things like that. But what the real issue is here is they're finding out what everybody already knew, I think, which was there's some real holes in this budget.
Well, and so set that up for us. What are the differences from what the House is? We'll get to revenues in a minute, but just what does the Senate want to do that's different from the House?
There are a couple of things they want to do. I mean, largely they don't want to take the rainy day fund, which the House did to help fund the budget. They don't want to take the renewable energy fund, which the House did to fund the budget. They want to increase the funding for the developmentally disabled services, mm-hmm. which was the by far, I think, the biggest focus of the public hearing this week. That was the issue that mm-hmm. brought most of those people out. Mm-hmm. They want to do some other adjustments in the health and human services, the senior Meals on Wheels program for one service link. They want to see if they can find the money to do that and various other things like that. But the problem is finding the money.
And Josh Rogers, the advocates for all of these kinds of services that the House cut or funded it less than what Governor Hassan proposed, they piled into the State House. We heard that very heartfelt testimony by a woman who lost her son asking for more substance abuse funding or treatment funding. How effective is it? We saw a similar procession back when the House was working on its version of the budget, the State House filled with advocates for social service programs, for the developmentally disabled, for substance abuse programming, for the elderly. Does that citizen participation affect lawmakers' votes and the flow of legislation?
Well, it certainly has an effect. I mean, it's real humans telling real stories about programs that affect their lives. But, you know, the other part of that is there's the basic arithmetic and the commitments that the senators and the House members have made. If you're going to – in the Senate, I mean, you know, if you just start to do the arithmetic of what Gary was talking about, if you're talking about restoring the rainy day fund, that's $10 million. If you talk about reversing the rate on the renewable energy fund, that's another $50 million. You're up to $60 million. You talk about funding the programs for seniors, that's, you know, millions more. And, you know, the math keeps on getting more steep. And then you also have the commitment not to have new taxes and fees. And you also have the priority of reducing – current business taxes. Now, the way those reductions might be structured would have a, you know, fairly small effect on this year's budget, on the coming budget. But I mean, it still you know, puts them in a box, and with the revenues not coming in as robustly as they might have hoped, it's going to be more difficult to conjure up the confidence that the money's going to be there when things have to be paid for. And you know, there are some bright spots. I mean, you know, the people seem to think the real estate transfer tax is could be strong, but still the math of this is going to be tough.
Dean Spiliotis, how does the Senate solve it if it's, as Josh says, maybe as much as $130 million problem they've got to solve? Revenues for April are coming in less than plan. How does the Senate go after this?
It's going to be very difficult. You know, as Josh has detailed, we're looking at upwards over $100 million plus in cuts to a number of these programs. And, you know, all along the narrative has been that, well, you know, the Senate was concerned about restoring some of these cuts, particularly to Health and Human Services. And the hope was they would have a better set of revenue estimates, that they would be a little bit higher than the House revenue estimates, even if they weren't quite as high as Governor Hassan's estimates. And as you mentioned, everybody had been kind of waiting for April because April is typically a big revenue month, and the revenue in April was lower than hoped for. We had $273 million, which is about $4 million or 1.5% less than what they had forecast. And in particular, business taxes were down almost $8 million or about 8.5%. So, you know, everybody had kind of been hoping for this extra revenue, given the parameters and the constraints that Gary mentioned. And it's just not clear how it's going to happen going forward, because they have said they're not going to have any new or increased taxes or fees. I just think it's going to be a very difficult exercise, and, you know, we'll see how they do it.
The calculators will be out for the next month in the Senate. I just want to remind listeners that they can join this conversation. You can call in. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Or you can email us at exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, the budget, of course, was not all of the action going on in the State House this week. Several bills are sort of developing towards their fruition and eventually heading towards Governor Hassan's desk. I wanted to ask about funding for nursing homes. This is something that is in the current fiscal year that Governor Hassan had reduced the funding from levels that nursing home advocates thought was appropriate. What happened there? Gary Reyna?
Well, we have to backtrack a little bit and say that the Department of Health and Human Services has a better than $50 million shortfall at one point. Mm-hmm. And so in order to make up that shortfall, they started grabbing money that wasn't being used in the department. And one of the things that they grabbed was about $7 million for nursing home rate increases and for home-based care rate increases. And so that was just that touched a nerve, and the nursing home people just turned out in force. And we had a bill actually come through the Senate that would have prevented such a thing from happening. The House Finance Committee has the bill, and they've been working for a while with the governor. And what they did is they found a way to offset the cut to the – or actually the rate increase that the nursing homes were actually counting on for this fiscal year. So they offset that with money that they didn't use for in home-based care. So it becomes a wash. I mean, one gets it and one doesn't. But the other one – the one that wasn't being used is going to – for the nursing home rate increase.
Okay, so it's a wash. They didn't find new revenues, but they are at least taking care of the nursing home advocates. So,
I mean, one thing that's interesting about this, beyond just the technical bit that Gary was talking about, is that this policy decision made by the governor way back when was something that became sort of a flashpoint between the governor and Senate budget writers, particularly Senate Finance Chair Jeanie Forrester, who sponsored the bill to reverse course. And this led to a lot of talk about how, you know, we're not going to raid dedicated funds. We're not going to take money from for one purpose, use it for another. And I guess we'll see how that pans out for the rest of this budget, because a lot of the pledges about – I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Renewable Energy Fund in particular moving forward, whether or not lawmakers can make good on their claims that money is going to be used for – dedicated money is going to be used for its express purpose.
And in a few minutes, we're going to have New Hampshire Public Radio's Sam Evans-Brown, who reports on the environment, to come talk about that fund in particular a little bit more and a few other things. This week, fetal homicide, it looks like it is on its way to becoming a crime in the state of New Hampshire. Some differences between the Senate and the House. Well, what are the dynamics there, and what happens when it gets to the governor's desk?
Sure. I mean, the issue is the logic behind the bill is that if a person is killed and is pregnant, a woman is pregnant, that you could in theory be charged with an additional homicide for the death of the fetus. And the debate is over kind of the timing, sort of, you know, do you start from a conception or, viability or, you know, sort of what is the definition? And that's a very difficult thing to determine. And there's, people who sort of pro-choice advocates are concerned that this could, in theory, be a slippery slope to kind of stricter regulations, depending on how you define a fetus. Mm-hmm. So I think that's where the debate is over kind of what the time frame is for when this actually becomes a homicide. But
speaking of time frames, we actually are coming up on our break. I'd like to return to this question in just a moment. You are listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Later on, we'll consider expansion plans for two of the state's ski areas and look at a standoff between Manchester and state education officials on Common Core standards. Stay with us for more of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Fred Bever in for Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, from budget battles to Deflategate. Please join us with your thoughts. Call in. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Tell us what you think the news of the week is. The email is exchange@nhpr.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm here with Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News, Josh Rogers, the senior political reporter for NHPR, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Now, Dean, just before we went to the break, we were talking about this fetal homicide bill. One interesting wrinkle this week was the New England Journal of Medicine came out with a study that found that the viability of a fetus may be earlier for some small percentage of fetuses than the scientific consensus and the medical consensus has been. Instead of the consensus being 24 weeks being the start, It's now maybe 22 weeks for some small proportion of fetuses, which has the potential to move the debate about, you know, the House saying it's 18 weeks, mm-hmm. the Senate saying viability. These are difficult questions.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's going to be very difficult to reach a consensus. You know, this I think there's some agreement that, you know, somebody should pay a price for it's an additional price for killing somebody who's pregnant. But, you know, this has the potential to kind of get wrapped into the larger debate over, you know, choice and viability and whether a fetus is a baby or not and all the kinds of issues that have been debated very passionately on both sides of the issue. And I think that's the concern. And, you know, there are all kinds of competing studies that I think kind of sort of cloud the issue mm-hmm. even further and make it very contentious.
Josh Rogers, Governor Hassan has been consistently supported by the advocacy groups for abortion rights. Has she given an indication of how she views this legislation?
Well, I think it's pretty clear she views it as legislation she'd just as soon not see on her desk. this is a thorny issue and something that certainly abortion rights groups don't like this. And while the bills, and it is 8 weeks for the House bill and point of viability in the Senate bill, They include language to carve out, you know, protections for, you know, fetuses harmed during an abortion or during a medical procedure. This is something that abortion rights types don't like, and this will be a tough one. I certainly would not be surprised if a version ends up on her desk if Governor Hassan were to veto it. But, you know, she hasn't really said where she is, so I guess we'll see. She tends to say that she reviews the bills carefully, and this was one she's going to be reviewing very carefully with a lot of input.
So there's not backroom negotiation going on over what the governor could handle. Gary Rennie,
well, I don't think there's backroom negotiations going on with the governor. Yeah. I mean, I think there's backroom negotiations going on between the House and the Senate. But the real problem with this bill, as far as she is concerned, is we go to the whole issue with the personhood and the Republican mm-hmm. plank. You're giving an unborn child the same rights, essentially, or maybe even more rights than you're giving the mother. And that's what the real issue is here for people who are on the pro-choice side.
Which has created some interesting dynamics within the Republican Party itself. The question of personhood. You have Steve Dupree, who's a national committeeman for the Republican Party, getting whacked this week by anti-abortion advocates. What was that about?
Well, I mean, he attended an event where fundraiser that which he claimed he didn't know was a fundraiser that would have benefited Planned Parenthood. He said he supports the health initiatives of Planned Parenthood, not the political wing. He's a national committee man in a party that is pro-life. And, he might have seen this coming, but people are agitated. And, he issued a statement saying that it was, you know, wrong for him to go on to this thing. But, people are going to be sore about this for some time and legitimately so for people for whom this is a fundamental issue and say if you're a party official, you're supposed to represent the platform. Mm-hmm. It's a fair fight. I mean, traditionally, plenty of New Hampshire Republicans have been and are pro-choice. But if you're going to be a doctrinaire follower of the platform, then that's another matter.
Yeah, and he has said very clearly he's not going to change his personal beliefs on the issue, but that he was not sort of part of the official list. He was invited by a friend. He didn't realize that it was going to be as kind of overtly political as it turned out to be. And then he said he left pretty quickly once he realized that it was sort of not appropriate for him to be there necessarily.
So this is an issue that resonates through all levels of politics, from the local to the state to the lobby to the presidential campaign that's coming. I want to return now to an issue that we brought up earlier when we were talking about the budget, which was the Renewable Energy Fund. And to help us understand that, joining us now in the studio is Sam Evans Brown. He covers environmental and educational issues for NHPR. Sam, what is this Renewable Energy Fund? It's worth $50 million, more than $50 million. It's big money. Why do some people say it shouldn't be used for the purposes that the House is looking at?
Well, so the intention of the Renewable Energy Fund is to, of course, incentivize the development of renewable energy. When we talk about the $50 million figure, that's based on sort of projections. And mm-hmm. what we're looking at is that this is a fund that the utilities are supposed to hit a certain percentage of renewable energy coming in their portfolio. And if they aren't hitting those numbers, then they're supposed to pay alternative payments. And over the years, the amount that they've been spending on alternative payments has been rising because renewable energy hasn't been meeting the percentages that they've been trying to hit. So right now it's not bringing in, you know, $25 million a year. It's more on the order of like 16, but mm-hmm. year over year it's been growing. And basically the question is, you know, what do you use this big pot of money for? And of course the intended purpose was to actually, you know, do that job to grow the amount of renewable energy in the state, but there's a big budget hole to fill.
Well, let me stop you right there. So the intended purpose in legislation, in language, it's law that it has to be used for renewable energy subsidies.
Yeah, that is exactly the case. About, you know, it's like 60-40 right now that go towards grants versus rebates. So, you know, when you put solar panels on your roof, you can get a check from the state after you install it. That comes from the Renewable Energy Fund. But also the sort of the lion's share, most of the money goes to these grant programs, these competitive grants where a bunch of projects will line up and say, we want to build X. It could be hydropower. It could be biomass. It could be solar. And they compete for the money that's left over. You know, for instance, the solar farm that they want to build on the landfill down in Manchester says it won't go forward unless it gets one of those grants.
So, and this could defund it for the coming year?
Yeah, not only would it defund the grant program, it would defund rebates. And a lot of the solar installers in the state, and that really is on the residential side, that's mostly what we're talking about is solar panels on people's roofs. They say that this is really going to put the hurt on them because that check that you get in the mail after having put, you know, an $18,000 solar array on your roof, that's a real big help for their business. And it becomes a lot harder to sell that. I mean, the checks, you know, for an $18,000 array, you could expect like $3,000 back from the state. Mm-hmm. So that's real money. And the equation for an individual homeowner becomes a lot more difficult without that incentive. And there are a lot of jobs now. I mean, we're talking Solar City coming to the state. They said they were going to hire 100 people to work in New Hampshire. So you're starting to see that there's really starting to become a lobby that can really push back against the idea about raiding this fund.
Josh Rogers.
Well, I mean, it ought to be said that the pushback against the raiding this fund may take the form of a lawsuit if it actually moves forward. There's talk of that, and there are people who believe that this would be struck down. You know, when it passed the House, House Finance Chairman Neil Kirk was quite confident that wasn't the case, but you know, it would be up to a judge if it came to that.
Gary Reno, there are sort of two issues in play. One is, how should dedicated funds be dedicated, and should they be reserved for what they originally intended for? But also, is there a lobby starting to appear? Did the solar lobby and the residential lobby go to work on the House? Are they working the Senate?
They're certainly working the Senate. That's for sure. I think they got kind of blindsided in the House. Dedicated funds, we can talk about it all we want, but they've been raided for a long time. Mm-hmm. And lawmakers can change. I mean, the law says this is to be used for this, but there's nothing to say that they can't change the law. Right. And that's what they did. I mean, the House changed the law.
They got rid of that language that said it's dedicated.
I mean, it's done. It's not like this is the first time it's been done. It's been done constantly. It's been done numerous times in the past. I mean, they've tried to grab a whole lot more money than this in the past.
Sam Evans.
I was just going to say the in terms of net beneficiaries of the money of the Renewable Energy Fund, the taxpayers, the general fund has been the biggest beneficiary of that fund. $16 million were raided the last time around, and that is by far, you know, where historically most of the money that generated by that program has gone to the general fund.
So, predicted outcome. Again, Dean, you were talking about the hard nut they have to crack. That's a lot of money to try to make up.
They'll get some money back, but they're not going to get all of it back, probably.
Yeah, I think that's probably yeah. True.
All right. So some hope for solar installers, but not the manna from heaven, perhaps, that had been there in the past. So, Sam, while you're here, I want to move on to some other issues having to do with ski area expansion, which you've been observing. First, the question of Les Otten's proposal for the Balsams. That was in the legislature this week, so I'll ask you legislative types. What happened? Wasn't this turned down a month and a half ago with the $28 million bond?
Well, it wasn't exactly turned down. I mean, there was a committee in the Senate that basically said, we want to put this off for a year. We want to retain the bill. We want to re-refer the bill. We want to wait for a year and work this out and see what happens. Then Les Otten came through and said, well, if we're going to go forward with it, we can't do this. I need to know one way or the other now. And so the Senate President, Chuck Morse, got involved. And then they got something through the Senate. Wasn't really what they needed, but they got something through. And in the House, they've been working on it, and they've been fine-tuning it. And so that's where we get to the point. I mean, it's basically got to do with a state business finance authority guarantee program. And what they found out essentially was, while they can – any town or city or business, a commercial enterprise or whatever could apply for the guarantees – who couldn't apply were what is called unincorporated places, of which there are 28 in the state. 26 of them are in Coos County. One of them is Dixville Notch, which is where the Balsams Resort is.
Well, so did Coos County sort of come in after that initial apparent failure and say, we got to have this?
Well, I think what they did was they figured, how are we going to do this? And this is one way we can do it, is get the county to be the taxing district.
Yeah, create a special tax district for this and do it that way. And, you know, my sense is the North Country really wants this. It's a big – it's like $140 million project, $143 million. The concern was that this initial $28 million state-backed loan, that if the resort falls or it doesn't pan out, that the state would be on the hook for that money. But I think there's a sense that they want to move forward with it. And now, I guess, because of the amendments, it goes back to the Senate for one more look.
But no, it's gone to the governor.
Oh, it's gone to the governor.
It's already gone to the governor. Okay, so they already went through the Senate.
They agreed to it yesterday.
And she's indicated her support.
Yeah, so it sounds like it'll
be. So ultimately, if it went south, is it the state taxpayers who are on the hook?
Oh, yes.
It's not the county taxpayers. It's not the county taxpayers.
Well, the guarantee – I mean, the state would have the – yeah. It's, well, either way, I mean, the public's on the hook one way or the other, whether it's the county or the state.
400 hotel rooms, more than 1,000 jobs. I can see why there is support, although there is always a risk in a situation like this. Now, another ski expansion proposal is on the table, and that's in Sunapee. Sam, I think we have a piece of tape from a meeting that you attended. Let's listen to Paul Johnson from Sunapee at this hearing on the proposed expansion.
It's a cleaner, safer, nicer place than it ever used to be, and I want to keep it moving in that direction. Give the families a place to play. Get the kids out of the friggin' couch looking at the video games and put them on a mountain where they'll have a life that they enjoy. Thank you.
Sam Evans Brown, what's this about? Is it a debate? It's one that we've heard before, isn't it?
This is a very long simmering debate. This has been on the table for over a decade. Basically, when the resort operator, they also operate Okemo over in Vermont, and when they took the lease over from the state, they immediately put this expansion on the table, and it was stonewalled for years during the Lynch administration. There was a court decision recently that sort of firmed up the maps that they had for the lease boundaries, and then, of course, when we had a new governor come in that sort of opened up the door to putting it back on the table. And so there's been this resurgence of a very, very old issue. And basically you have the folks in the towns around Sunapee, especially Goshen, which is where the West Bowl is. That's what we're talking about, the western side of the mountain, who are concerned that this expansion is going to lead to increased development in their town. And there are people in that town who see that as a bad thing. They come to Goshen because they like the bucolic setting. And so they're concerned that they're going to be sort of condominiums sprouting up all around these trails, sort of, ski in, ski out condos. And that has long been the nut of the issue. And so all of a sudden, about a couple weeks ago in mid-April, the state said that they were going to allow the expansion, and they were going to allow it in exchange for the expansion was going to cross out of the state park onto private property. And so in order for the expansion to go through, the developer had to donate about 400 acres in order to put 150 of that the ski trails would actually be on, and the rest would be to sort of sweeten the pot as more land put into conservation in the state park. But that was the rough outlines of the deal. You can have this expansion, but you have to give us more state park in order to do it.
Well, that seems to satisfy two goals, one for development, one for environmental conservation. Does the state as a whole care about Sunapee expanding, or is it really very focused on the local community there?
Well, certainly Sunapee. I mean, it's the number two most visited mountain in the state. I mean, it's Loon and then Sunapee. So there are a lot of people who ski there, and there are a lot of people who like the mountain. I mean, a lot of people call it sort of a gem, and you definitely have that crowd. In terms of who's really worked up about the development going on in those towns, that's a different question. It's really hard to say to what extent this is a local versus a statewide issue. But the whole state gets to chime in because it's a state park, and so it's a state decision as to whether it expands.
Are the owners asking for any support from the state the way Les Auten is with Balsams?
No, they're basically doing it all on their own. I mean, the support that they would get is the ability to use those state lands, and so one could argue to what extent that is support.
And finally, what's next with this? When does it become done or not done?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. It's not 100% clear. There's a comment period on the proposed deal that the state put forward that ends in the beginning of June. But Commissioner Rose, Commissioner of the Department of Resources and Economic Development, has been very cagey about what he saying when he would issue a final decision. And certainly, you know, the first time around when the fall when this first came up, comments were mostly in favor of the expansion. Mm-hmm. This time around, it seems like the opponents have really managed to mobilize a lot more of their people. So at that public hearing, you know, it was you know, I have 78 against and 18 for in terms of people speaking. So the equation in terms of support for the expansion may have flipped. I mean, we'll see once the written comments all roll in, but it might be tough to push this thing through.
Well, that brings me to a kind of question that I asked Josh Rogers earlier about testimony before the legislature, which is, how much does that stuff matter? Isn't what really matters is where the commissioner and the governor are at, what the governor wants the commissioner to do, you know, how much lobbying heft the support for Sunapee has versus that against? I mean, isn't that where it really counts?
So certainly in the past, this has been an issue that's been a case study for showing the power of the governor, right? When Governor Lynch was in office, he didn't want this to happen, and so it didn't happen. From what I've heard, and you know, you can never know exactly where the governor's at on an issue unless she tells you, but from what I've heard, she just wants there to be a full, fair, and open process on this question. I don't know if she is for or against the expansion herself. So it seems to have been, the ball mostly seems to have been in Commissioner Rose's court. And you know what he'll do with a new resurgence of opposition. That's a very good question.
Okay, well, we'll keep on watching for that. Coming up, we turn to some other topics in the news this week. Chris Christie's first foray here since Bridgegate blew up, or at least since some indictments came down. Does this week's report on Deflategate take any air out of the Patriots brand? We'll be looking at all of that on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is NHPR. Good morning. It's 9:39.
This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. We have all of our wonderful guests here in the studio, including Sam Evans Brown, environmental and educational reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Sam, I wanted to ask you, this week there was sort of a flare-up in the debate over Common Core standards and the standardized testing that goes along with that, called Smarter Balance. In Manchester this week, the chief of education for the state, Virginia Berry, had a hearing, and she spoke with also Ted Gatzis, the mayor of Manchester. Manchester doesn't like it. What's going on here?
Yeah, so what I would say is, you know, okay, to sort of set the stage a little bit, I mean, Manchester has been the district that has most prominently pushed back against the new standardized tests that have come down in association with the Common Core, and also against the Common Core themselves. They actually rewrote, they sort of took the Common Core and tweaked the language here and there to develop their own standards. A lot of people that I showed them to sort of said they're basically the same thing as the Common Core, but you know, they did look them over and make a few changes here and there. And so there's been this sort of, you know, long-standing pushback between Manchester and the State Department of Education over these standards and the tests associated with them. And also, I'd say, long-standing sort of failure of communication between the Department of Education and Manchester. When Manchester was working on these standards, they were working under the assumption that they would not have to do the Smarter Balance test, that they would be able to administer different tests in as as you know, go their own way, basically. For the 10th graders, they wanted to do the SATs. I'm not sure exactly what they had in mind for the lower grades, but they were looking into it. And then they learned sort of very late in the game, basically the end of last year, that no, indeed, they would have to take the Smarter Balance test. And the whole district wasn't really preparing to do it. And so they had to sort of retool very quickly, get ready to take this test, which was entirely computerized. I think this was just another chapter in this saga, is that you've got the district and the state not communicating very well. It's led to real problems at the district where they've had to change things very quickly. Mm-hmm. And so they basically, you know, they called her to the carpet.
Well, Gary Reno, why is this happening? Is this about local control? Is this about sort of a Republican ideological opposition to the Obama administration coming in and creating this institution of Common Core? What's going on here?
Well, I think you have to go back quite a ways to step back. And Manchester is a strange government, the way it works, because the mayor is also the head of the school board, which doesn't usually happen. Uh-huh. And so Ted Gatzis has been advocating for a long time for opting out Manchester from all of these tests. When we used to have the districts in need of improvement, I mean, Manchester always performed very poorly. And Ted's contention always is, I mean, here we have a school district that has all these 52 languages in the school system, all these kids as second language, all the immigrants coming in. We're not being given a fair share when we take these tests and we get compared to everybody else. And so this is the sort of the foundation of what this is all about. And it became very easy to focus on the Common Core when this all came down. This is why this isn't fair to Manchester, because Manchester has issues that no other place has.
Okay,
in the
so
state.
It's fairly localized. Yeah. So now, Sam, thanks very much. I really appreciate you coming in and talking about the various items, renewable energy and education, and the ski areas. Want to move on now to presidential politics. And Josh, you're something of a candidate tracker these days on the journalistic side, and you followed Chris Christie about a little bit today. He's back. Is he trying to sort of rehab himself?
Well, it was interesting. Chris Christie, he's here now. He arrived yesterday, and you know, his first stop was at the Farnham Center, which is a drug and alcohol rehabilitation center. And you know, well, in the one sense, I was sort of like, well, you know, the story kind of writes itself, sort of like, you know, slumping in the polls, like, you know, Christie looks for rehabilitation at rehab center kind of thing. But, you know, he this is an issue, he said, of longstanding concern for him. He was a big supporter of drug courts, he said, in New Jersey. He spoke, you know, movingly about a friend of his from law school who ended up dying after becoming addicted to pain pills in the wake of a back injury. And he said that this needs to be an issue that's more front and center politically. It was interesting. Hillary Clinton said much the same, said a similar thing when she campaigned in Keene. You know, it's true that, you know, speaking just politically, Chris Christie is in a different spot than he used to be, you know, a year ago. I mean, he was here a lot. He was perceived by pretty much everyone as in the top tier of Republican candidates. A poll came out from WMUR conducted by UNH that had Christie at 3%, and you know, one of the candidates that Republican voters said they were least likely to vote for. He was asked about that yesterday. He said, you know, I'll work the other 95% that haven't made up their minds. And he said that he doesn't feel he needs to change his approach, although he's been here a lot. He's going to be giving an economic speech here next month. You know, we're a long ways away. We've got a million candidates running on the Republican side. It's hard to know where this is going. But if Christie is to rehabilitate himself, New Hampshire is going to be a big part of that or not.
Yeah, and he's banking on that it's still early. You know, the WMUR Granite State poll that had him at 3% this week, you know, also showed that a lot of people really aren't paying that much attention at this point. Yeah, he's in a tough spot. You know, in 2012, Republican donors were begging him to run for president. Now you have this top tier of candidates, which really, at least certainly in New Hampshire, closely clustered Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, and Rand Paul. Those four are really the four to watch at this moment. And Christie finds himself a little bit on the outside trying to break back into that. And, you know, he's had more bad news in New Jersey with his a couple more of his close advisors and staffers being charged in the Bridgegate scandal, one pleading guilty. So there's just a lot swarming around him still. If he's going to compete anywhere, it's going to be here in New Hampshire. In theory, he should be a good fit for the state for a variety of reasons. We'll see if he can do it by sheer force of will and retail politics.
I mean, there are examples where that's worked. I mean, it certainly worked for John McCain. I mean, he had the benefit of having won.
He had
the benefit of having won the New Hampshire primary before, which is something that certainly Chris Christie did. You know, then you can put in people like John Huntsman, who was supposed to, you know, be competing in Florida and South Carolina, and then, you know, banked it all on New Hampshire, managed to come in third, and then, you know, was quickly out of the race.
And Hillary Clinton turned herself around a bit in New Hampshire, too.
After she lost
Iowa,
right?
Yeah. So, Josh, who held, you know, Carly Fiorina, Bernie Sanders both formally announced, although, of course, we knew that they were in before this week. Who else is in town? Who's coming through? What's the
Rick Perry state of the game? Rick Perry, who's actually, you know, in terms of actual number of campaign events, he may have done more campaigning in New Hampshire than any other Republican. He's been here. Christie's going to be back next week. Some of the more low profile candidates, George Pataki, they're going to be around. I mean, it's going to continue to be busy. And, you know, it's an open question of like when and if a winnowing process is going to take place, because, you know, I'm glad I'm not organizing the debates if there are, in fact, 18 of these people then.
That's a big concern, right? I mean, they're trying to figure they've said they're going to have a number of debates. And the concern is, how do you have 19 people on a stage? So they've got to figure out kind of what the criteria are going to be. You know, do you use some polling threshold of 5% maybe or something like that, or combine it with some sort of algorithm about money raised? And so it's a legitimate concern. And, you know, we typically assume that, you know, we've got the Iowa straw poll in August, and then you've got the Iowa caucus, that, you know, this stuff will kind of sort itself out. But, you know, what if we come into New Hampshire and there still are 4, 5, 6 candidates who are clustered very closely and split the vote? I mean, that may point towards a longer primary season than I think people typically expect.
Well, and certainly the Republicans hope to engineer this election to avoid the protracted process that they feel hurt Mitt Romney last time. And, you know, we'll see if they've you know, turn that trick when we get there. But right now, it's hard to, this is wide, wide open.
Are you seeing any trends that because there really is this highly competitive race on the Republican primary side, that unenrolled voters are going to sort of gravitate towards that? Garino?
Well, they always do. I mean, independent voters, as we call them here, although they're really undeclared, independent voters are always the ones who decide these elections, whether they're general elections or presidential primaries. They go where the action is, and they're the ones who swing it one way or the other for candidates. So, I mean, if you're trying to attract these people to your side, I mean, you're going to have a lot better chance if you're more of a moderate than you are really a conservative in New Hampshire.
Or at least perceived as one. One thing that, you know, you talk to – I was talking to – I mean, it's interesting. Jeb Bush is another person for whom New Hampshire is seen as being crucial. And, you know, you talk to people who are around his campaign and they say, you know, we recognize that, Jeb Bush and the Bush name may not, you know, fire up every conservative activist out there. But they say if there are multiple candidates in there, they feel that they can – be enough of a second choice for a lot of these folks that it could augur to their benefit. There's a tranche of these conservative folks, and whether or not they get winnowed out in Iowa and then, one or two of them campaign here after that. I mean, we're a long ways from any of that.
Right,
but
great,
this is
a great example is Mike Huckabee, who just announced that he's getting into the race. Mm-hmm. He won the Iowa caucus, did not do well in New Hampshire. We just may not see him that much this time. You know, you've got Iowa where something like 60-65% of the voters in the caucus, Republican caucus, are evangelical Christians. You've got South Carolina where I think 60% of the Republican voters self-identify as religious conservatives. So you may see this sort of sorting where we get the kind of more moderate candidates candidates who can make a pitch to the independents, and people like Huckabee and Ted Cruz and others focus more on South Carolina.
Well, and you have a lot of the talk of people waiting for the big sort of so-called super Southern sort of
SEC
all of these where a lot of these conservatives say, well, you know, we can get there and we may not have to run as hard or do as well in New Hampshire. I mean, it may end up being shades of Rudy Giuliani saying, oh, I can wait till the Florida primary. I mean, certainly people, you know, winning New Hampshire is going to remain a big deal, but it's there are a lot of people running, and it's interesting.
And so more fertile territory for Mike Huckabee out in Iowa than here in the ledge of the Granite State. So we have a caller who wants to weigh in on some presidential issues. Tom, please join us.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
As I've been listening to the roundup, I've just been hearing a lot about the Republicans, and certainly there are a lot of them out there, but it just seems to me that they're all pretty much just different flavors of Republicans. And it seems to me like the big news in the presidential primaries this year is that Bernie Sanders has joined the race, which is quite different from Hillary, and now there's a real race on the Democratic side. So I'd like to hear your comments on Bernie Sanders getting in.
Any of you gentlemen, I'm sure, have thoughts about the Social Democrat from Vermont?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, progressive Democrats have been kind of unhappy with the Hillary Clinton candidacy. They want somebody to challenge her. They have not been able to get Elizabeth Warren into the race, so Bernie Sanders jumped in. This WMUR poll that just came out has Hillary at about 51%, which is a drop for her, and Bernie Sanders at about 13%. So, you know, I think the biggest challenge – I mean, I think Bernie will certainly have an impact on the discourse in the campaign. He's going to have to demonstrate that he can kind of resonate with voters, you know, beyond New Hampshire, beyond the Upper Valley, and sort of, you know, see how he does in Iowa and South Carolina and kind of a national candidacy. But he's certainly going to kind of countervail the kind of traditional kind of Clinton economic approach.
Tom, it's a tough road for Bernie Sanders. He doesn't have the kind of money and the boots on the ground that Hillary Clinton already has. I think, Josh, I heard you say the other day she has 15 staffers. Going, are you going to go to work for Bernie Sanders? Are you organizing for him? Tom, are you still there?
I am still here.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Please
now?
Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, I'm absolutely looking at that. I really like what he has to say. It seems like he's got a pretty pretty clear platform. And regarding the fundraising, he just got in the race, and within just a few days, he pulled in $6 million. I think that there's more there than just a countervailing argument to Hillary.
Josh Rogers.
But we'll see.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Tom raises a good point, and it will be interesting. I mean, I was at a Clinton a house party organized by the Clinton campaign at which Senator Clinton wasn't there, and I was talking to, you know, loyalists to Clinton, and, you know, some of them said, look, anybody who gets into this race is going to start with, you know, a slug of people who just aren't going to be satisfied with Senator Clinton, and, you know, this person put that number, like, you know, you can expect someone to get 30%. You know, we'll see. I mean, we know where Sanders is in the polls now. We'll have to see what kind of campaign he can run. I mean, the Clinton people have vast financial advantages, and in New Hampshire, they have the advantage of having people who have a track record of winning elections here working on her behalf. So he's got his work cut out for him, but certainly interesting to have somebody sharing the stage and, you know, bringing views that a lot of core Democrats are more in line with than some of what Hillary Clinton stands for.
The debates, if there are debates between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, that could be some pretty good television as far as debates go, and potentially, you know, very important for Bernie Sanders to have that platform for his message.
Yeah, he's very passionate. He's very sort of focused. He's been consistent over the years in sort of his kind of economic message. He'll get a lot more attention now than he would have in a large multi-field candidate. And I think so. Those are all positives for him. But it absolutely is going to be an uphill battle.
Well, and will if he starts to gain traction, you know, would that trigger other people to get in the race potentially? I mean, that remains to be seen. And if they did, where would they be taking? You know, I mean, again, we're a million miles away here. But would they be taking votes from him or from Hillary Clinton? And, you know, it's going to be interesting to watch.
Thanks, Tom, for your call. Very quickly, just before we leave the show today, the report on Deflategate came out, more probable than not, that Tom Brady knew that a New Hampshire locker room attendant was deflating those footballs. Dean Spiliotis, is the Brady brand hurt? Should he be censured? What do you think Patriots Nation says?
Certainly not hurt in New Hampshire or New England. He's tremendously popular, as we saw at the event that he just did yesterday. You know, outside of New England, Patriots are always kind of hated for their winning ways, and this just gives people more fuel on the fire. But you know, the Patriots and Tom Brady in particular are arguing that this is kind of circumstantial. The texts that they're using from the locker room attendant and the equipment manager kind of suggest that Brady is unhappy about the pressure and the balls, but there's no specific smoking gun that him telling them to actually do this. And so we'll see.
Ticket sales in New Hampshire probably won't be hurt too badly.
No.
Well, thank you very much, Dean Spiliotis, the civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and the author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. Thanks also to you, Gary Reno, the State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Thanks a lot for coming
in. You're welcome.
And, of course, Josh Rogers, New Hampshire Public Radio's own senior political reporter. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producers are Faith Mikesell and Jason Moon. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Fred Bever, sitting in for Laura Kanoy. Thanks so much for joining the New Hampshire Public Radio Friday News Roundup on The Exchange.